This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And this is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, where our guest this evening, we are very fortunate to have with us John Nichols, who is a reporter and author and a blogger at The Nation magazine. He's on the board of the Media Reform Group, the Free Press, and he's one of the best rally speakers I've ever had the misfortune to follow. John, it's great to have you with us this evening.
It's great to be with you, David, and I have to, if we're honest with our audience, I'll have to say there have been a few times where you have followed me and shamed me by doing so much better. So we've been a good team all over the country for the last year, more than a year now, talking about the unspoken issue of American politics, at least in most of our media, and that is holding the President of the United States and the Vice President to account for their high crimes and misdemeanors.
And when you speak at events around the country, as you've been doing for many months here, what would you say is the one three-syllable word that can get the biggest applause?
Well, you know, it actually is the word impeach. It's a funny thing. This word is so charged and so powerful. People know it's linked to their Constitution. They know it's linked to the history of the Republic. They understand the dynamism of an impeachment process, and I think they certainly understand the necessity of it. So usually when I speak to large crowds, what I do initially is not mention the word. I'll get up and talk about the war in Iraq and some of the nightmarish realities that have played out as a result of that war, particularly some stories of vets that I've had the good fortune of meeting over the last year. And then when I've frankly said enough depressing things about the horrible state of the war and the Bush administration's intention of keeping the war going and even expanding it into Iran, and then when I've mentioned the fact that the Democrats in Congress seem to be unwilling or unable to confront the President on basic issues of war funding, I always say, don't despair. We are the descendants of patriots who overthrew a king named George. And then I usually say, and so I feel a duty to say to you tonight, my name is John Nichols, and I want to impeach the President. And invariably at that point, and I think it has a lot less to do with my speaking skills than it does with the mood and the sentiment of the crowd, as you've seen, David, we usually have a standing ovation. And I think it has an awfully lot to do with a pent-up emotion, people wanting to let loose and say, yes, we want to impeach.
I've seen it time and again, and it seems to continue to grow remarkably at this late date, or maybe it's not that late a date. As many of our listeners may already know, John, you've not only spoken about impeachment, you've written a book about it called The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. And this book has enlightened me and countless Americans about impeachment as something that, through our history, has perhaps been more common, more frequent, more necessary, more expected of us, and also more politically safe and advantageous than a lot of us might have thought. So I kind of want to ask you two questions. One is about the morality. Is there any ethical argument for putting electoral concerns ahead of impeachment, basing your impeachment decision on electoral calculations? And secondly, what is the accuracy of calculating at this point in our history that bringing up impeachment would hurt the parties that brought it up?
Well, those are two great questions, and both of which I want to answer. I hope my memory keeps me to both of them if I don't get to every aspect, keep prompting me. But let's go to the first aspect of that, which I think is so important, and that is the morality question, the duty question. And the fact of the matter is that the founders of this republic did not, in the Constitution of the United States, outline electoral processes. they did set up an electoral college, which frankly, as we all know, was really more of a barrier to democracy than an encourager of democracy. But they did not mention political parties, conventions, primaries, caucuses. They didn't mention funding sources for elections. They didn't even mention how often elections would be held or at what time of year. So they really put very little emphasis on the electoral process, not because they didn't respect it. They did believe that America would be an evolving democracy, just as Britain was at that time, and that people would choose their leaders. They knew initially it would be small groups of elites, and I think that the better of their number, people like Tom Paine and Jefferson and Madison, hoped that over time the base of electors, the base of people who would choose presidents and members of Congress would grow. But they didn't really go into a lot of detail. On the other hand, they went into immense detail about impeachment. There are six separate references to impeachment. It is the only procedure of the federal government, I emphasize that, the only procedure of the federal government that is outlined specifically in the Constitution, how it works, when it works, who does it, who does what, when, why, all the aspects of it. And I think the reason for that is very, very clear. The founders knew that we would figure out, without a lot of trouble, how to pick our leaders. They thought that presidents were very secondary figures, not, you know, anything like a king. They were people who would be transitory. You'd have one for a while, get another one, then another one, then another. But they were very, very concerned that none of those transitory figures who held the presidency or the vice presidency would use that position to make himself a king. They were terrified about a restoration of a monarchy. And so I think they gave impeachment a precedence, a moral precedence over the electoral process. Not to say that impeachment is at odds with the electoral process. They respected the electoral process. But they said that the notion that somehow an election was more important than the ability of the people to throw off a tyrannical leader at the moment that tyranny was identified, I don't think they'd ever go for the election first. I think they would always have said that the impeachment was most important. And so
should you impeach if your constituents would be opposed to it? You know,
I think even then you still, this is one of those areas where the judgment of a member of Congress, if they judge that a tyrannical moment has been reached, if they judge that you're at a point where the President of the United States, Vice President of the United States, is acting in a monarchical manner, then certainly if your constituents are saying, yes, you must act on this, you should. But even if it is your own judgment as an official that tyranny is afoot, that it is at hand, I think there is a moral imperative to act, not wait till the next election, but to act immediately. Remember, the next election is the point at which those who impeach can be held to account. If they do it inappropriately, if they misuse the power, if they abuse the power, they'll be voted out of office, and that will solve the problem. But if you don't act against tyranny at the moment that it's playing out, then you really have surrendered the whole concept of the American experiment. So I think it's a pretty clear, there's a pretty clear indication from the founders. And the people have generally understood this, David. In fact, throughout the history of the Republic, there have been, up to this president, 9 separate attempts to impeach presidents of the United States. In all of those efforts to impeach a president of the United States, each time it was done, where the effort was brought by the opposition party or members of the opposition party in Congress, at the next election, that party either maintained or improved its position. Never in the history of the Republic has a political party been meaningfully harmed or sanctioned in any way for putting impeachment forward. It is a fantasy.
What you've just said is absolute blasphemy, as you know, on Capitol Hill, where the accepted wisdom is that the impeachment of Clinton decimated the Republican Party. Can you speak to that idea?
Well, I certainly can. I mean, let's talk about the destination. In 1998, when Republicans raised the specter of impeachment, and during the course of the 1998 electoral campaign, talked openly about and moved toward the impeachment of a president, Bill Clinton. What happened? Well, Republicans retained control of both the U.S. House and the Senate in that election. Now, almost immediately after that election, they began the impeachment process itself. Obviously, they had not been so frightened by the election that they decided not to impeach. They went ahead and, in fact, voted to impeach Bill Clinton. Now, here's the interesting thing. The House impeached Clinton, then the Senate refused to convict him. So what happens in the 2000 election? Republicans actually improved their position somewhat in the House of Representatives, but they fall back in their position in the Senate, which didn't see the process through. So if our belief is that impeachment has an impact on the electoral processes of the country, then the conclusion we must take from the Clinton impeachment is that the people rewarded the impeachers and punished those who did not see the process through. Now, I know that that's not the way that an awfully lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill want to remember it, but what I would just remind them of is this. For the better part of the last decade, since the Clinton impeachment played out, Republicans controlled the whole of the federal government, the House, the Senate, and the presidency. If that is the punishment for impeaching a president of the other party, then I would suggest that Democrats might be very wise to get about the business of doing so immediately, if only to improve their electoral fortunes.
Good advice. John, let me tell people who are listening that this is the People Speak Radio with David Swanson. We're speaking with John Nichols, the author of The Genius of Impeachment, and we will be taking questions through Pal Talk by email and over the telephone. You can call in and join us at 888-228-4494. This is a toll-free call, 888-228-4494. John, I don't know if you saw the latest from John Conyers yesterday being questioned about impeachment by Rob Call, who's the editor of opednews.com. But Conyers' concern, and it has been more or less the same over the past year and a half or so, if we were to bring impeachment and try to pass impeachment and fail, that, you know, not the deaths in Iraq, not the erosion of the rule of law, et cetera, but that failure to pass the vote for impeachment, which he seems pretty confident would be a failure, would be a disaster. The media would attack, the Republicans would attack, and it would hurt the Democrats and therefore the world in the next election. So it's a little bit of a twist on bringing up impeachment and doing it is bad. Here, bringing up impeachment and failing to do it is somehow bad. What's your response?
Well, look, I have immense respect for John Conyers, probably more respect for him than just about anybody in Congress. And the one thing that the founders would have told us is this: even those political leaders that you respect can now and again be wrong. That's why the power of this republic was vested in the people. And in this case, John Conyers is misreading the situation. First and foremost, he is right that we have a media in this country that is absolutely sold out to the status quo, that is absolutely a defender of those in power and an opponent of efforts to hold them to account. That is that's totally true, and John Conyers is right to fear the media reaction. He is also right to know that the Republicans would certainly try to use impeachment as a political tool to try and resurrect their fortunes. These things are both true. But where he's making his mistake is assuming that the insurmountable power of the evidence against George Bush and Dick Cheney could somehow be reversed merely by media coverage or even Republican spin. And I just don't think that's the case. I think that if the House Judiciary Committee were to open impeachment hearings at this point, and simply detail what you and I and a lot of people who are activists, but frankly not all Americans know about the high crimes and misdemeanors of the Bush administration, that the support for impeachment would be so overwhelming that the fears of a status quo media coverage or a Republican spin would seem very quickly to be ridiculous. And in the end, most of the media would actually begin to come around. It wouldn't do its job, but it would follow what would turn out to be a pretty good story. And yeah, the Republicans would kick and scream right up to the point where one or two Republicans stepped forward and said, look, you know, this has gone too far. I'm in favor of impeachment. And then got an overwhelming positive response, at which point other Republicans would step up. And at the end of the day, I think that this is really a gut check question. It's not about all the political calculations. It is, do you think, as somebody who's followed the last 7 years, that George Bush and Dick Cheney have committed high crimes and misdemeanors? If you do, then you have to be for impeachment. And if you believe the evidence is as overwhelming as I do, then you have to believe that if a congressional committee were simply to put that evidence on the table and in a repeated and effective and focused manner, that the outcry for impeachment would be overwhelming and would come very quickly.
Now, Gerald Nadler, congressman from New York, chairs what is perhaps the most relevant subcommittee in the Judiciary Committee that covers the Constitution, the subcommittee where, for example, Dennis Kucinich's resolution on impeaching Cheney has been sitting since last April. And his position is another variation on the theme. At least relatively recently, his justification seemed to focus on the problem that we have political parties in this country, presumably something that the founders never envisioned. And that means that Republicans will never vote against a president of their party, which means that even if the Democrats decided to impeach and all of the Democrats came around and the Democrats, having a majority in the House, went ahead and impeached, conviction in the Senate is absolutely guaranteed not to happen because there are too many Republicans there. And so given that we have political parties and such loyalty to political parties, impeachment really isn't there in the Constitution anymore, and we should all sort of shut up and go away. What's your response?
Well, I hope that Gerald Nadler would rethink that sort of calculus for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, there's no question that impeachment is still very much in the Constitution. It's more a part of the Constitution today than it really was at the founding of the Republic. That's because this is a tried and true remedy that has been used again and again, roughly 70 times, to remove corrupt judges, to address the inequities and illegalities of members of the cabinet, in a number of different instances as regards presidential excesses, not always seen through to the final stage, but seen through to the stage where action was taken, i.e. Richard Nixon resigning, or presidents who had been threatened with impeachment not seeking re-election, and thus you have the impact, whether you have the final trial and that. So impeachment has worked again and again throughout the history of the Republic, and in most of that history there were political parties, and I think that the only advice I would give to Congressman Nadler in this circumstance is simply read your recent history, and remember that Democrats in the House voted with Republicans, not all Democrats, of course, but a number of Democrats in the House voted with Republicans to impeach Bill Clinton. And Republicans in the Senate voted with the Democrats against convicting Bill Clinton. So you had people who crossed partisan lines, and actually the person in the Senate who understands impeachment probably better than just about anybody, Arlen Specter, chose not to vote with his Republican colleagues for convicting Clinton on what really were badly drawn impeachment charges. I think this notion that political parties are the barrier is just foolish. And then if we go back to the Nixon impeachment in the 1970s, what we quickly realize is, with even a cursory reading of the history of what occurred there, that none of it would have happened without Republicans. It was Democratic committee chairmen who were holding the committee hearings and ultimately the votes on whether to impeach, but both Sam Ervin, who really did the initial Watergate hearings in the Senate, and then Peter Rubino, who was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee that brought three articles of impeachment against Nixon, said they would not go forward without Republican assistance and support. And they did not. Remember that the articles of impeachment voted against Richard Nixon all received votes from Republicans in the House, and in fact, in some cases, received substantial Republican support. So Jerry Nadler on this is just wrong. Political parties have not been a barrier to impeachment. In fact, impeachment has usually, not always, but usually called people to cross partisan lines and created moments where you saw a rare and very special bipartisanship.
This is certainly very useful. I'm going to send a recording of this to Nancy Pelosi.
I'm sure she'll be thrilled to get it.
She will. This is the People Speak Radio, David Swanson, with our guest John Nichols, the author of The Genius of Impeachment. And you can call in this evening with your questions toll-free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. So assuming that that this makes sense, that it can be done, that it can be bipartisan, that once it's underway, it would roll forward, what about the widespread notion that it's simply too late at this date? And how does the case of Harry Truman speak to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the notion that it's ever too late to impeach is, again, against the basic principles of the Republic and certainly the intents of the founders. The founders made it very clear that you could impeach at any time in a presidency or vice presidency. And in fact, there's every reason to believe that they intended that you be able to impeach someone after they had left office. That's why they made a very specific provision in the Constitution itself for impeachment as the rationale for impeachment, or how you would get to impeachment, would be to say that any individual who is accepting any of the benefits of office, and that's a key term in the Constitution as regards how you're defining someone in their office. Well, today, when we have former presidents of the United States accept huge pensions and full Secret Service protection, as well as a host of other benefits of office that extend well beyond their terms in office, it's quite clear that the founders saw a very broad interpretation of impeachment that was not limited by certain time frames or certain periods. Now, within the term of a member of the executive branch, it is safe to say that impeachment usually does not come at the start of one's tenure. That really would be an inappropriate impeachment if you just said, well, we don't like the fact that this person's president, so we're going to try and impeach them. We don't really have many reasons for it. We're just going to do it. Well, that just would be wrong, and it would be unacceptable, and the American people would reject it.
So unless they call the election, then the Supreme Court put them in a sort of a...
Well, that's actually a very good reason, but I think you begin there by impeaching the Supreme Court, which is, of course, something you can do. But here's the bottom line. The rationale for impeachment develops over time. And so in most of the history of impeachment, we find that impeachments are played out toward the end of presidencies, not at the beginning. Thus, you saw with Bill Clinton an impeachment in the final 2 years, the final period of his presidency. With Richard Nixon, an impeachment in the midst of his second term as president. With Andrew Johnson, an impeachment literally taking place, Andrew Johnson in the 1860s, literally taking place just weeks before the Republican National Convention that would nominate his successor. And again throughout history. Historically, one of the most fascinating examples was 1932 and early 1933, after Herbert Hoover had lost his campaign for re-election as president, Republicans in the House of Representatives twice successfully moved for votes on impeaching Herbert Hoover, or for procedural votes toward an impeachment of Herbert Hoover, in December and January of the period after the election. So they were actually trying to impeach him after he was already voted out of office, but before he he'd surrendered the office at the final stage. And famously, the one you reference and my favorite historical impeachment effort was in 1952. This was at the very end of Harry Truman's presidency, after he had announced that he was not seeking re-election, not seeking another term. He ordered seizure of the steel plants in the United States as a extension of his war powers, his authority as the president in a time of war. Republicans who opposed the war in Korea at the time moved articles of impeachment saying, first and foremost, that the war itself was not declared, so he had no war powers. And secondly, that even if it had been declared, that the authority of a president in a time of war did not extend to the seizure of domestic industries. And the interesting thing was that they brought those resolutions in the House, got a tremendous amount of national publicity in the spring of 1952, and within hours of when the news came that they were moving for impeachment, and in fact when a key Republican in the Senate, Everett Dirksen, said he thought there's a very good chance that impeachment might in fact move forward, the U.S. Supreme Court, made up entirely of appointees of Harry Truman and of Franklin Roosevelt, his predecessor, stepped in an unprecedented move, seized the case, said, look, we're going to decide this immediately. They jumped over all the procedural hoops and came down with a ruling in barely a month, and thus averted the necessity of a congressional action by taking it into the judiciary, and, as history tells us, of course, prevented Truman from doing what he had sought to do with the steel plants. Bottom line here is that was an impeachment initiative played out at the equivalent of this coming spring, not played out, you know, at this early stage like January of the last year of a president's term, but in deep into the spring and toward the summer. And so, I mean, the notion that there's ever a too late is absurd. In fact, the idea that we would say that any time in a president's term is too late to hold him or her to account is essentially saying to that president, well, you can be a king, you can be a monarch for the last year or the last 2 years of your term because we won't do anything to stop you. There could not, in my mind, be a more dangerous signal to send in a constitutional republic than that one.
Well, I think we've sent it, and I think it's been heard loud and clear.
I think you're probably right.
I want to get into some of the recent examples of Bush's belief that he's a monarch, but we have a caller on the line, and I'd like to bring him in. Let me remind everyone, this is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio with our guest John Nichols, the author of The Genius of Impeachment. You can join us toll-free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Let's go to Mike in California. Mike, you're on with John Nichols.
Thank you, David. Hello, John. Thank you for coming on the show. John, it seems to me that the most important thing is that this administration be held accountable so that these offenses are seen as offenses and they are not passed on to the next president. With that in mind, what do you think about impeachment after Bush and Cheney leave the office?
I certainly don't mind impeachment after someone's left office. In fact, historically, there's a great example of where this would have been appropriate. In 1974, when Richard Nixon resigned, before the House of Representatives voted to impeach him, a group of House members, including several members of the Judiciary Committee, proposed that they go ahead with the impeachment vote anyway, on the theory that, despite the fact that Nixon had resigned, it was absolutely essential to send the signal, to make it absolutely clear, that the House of Representatives believed that the sort of actions Nixon had engaged in needed to be sanctioned, that the president needed to be held to account in such a circumstance. Unfortunately, Tip O'Neill, Peter Rodino, and others believed that they had essentially gotten their pound of flesh from Richard Nixon and didn't really want to play the scenario out. As it turned out, that was a terrible mistake because Gerald Ford, shortly thereafter, pardoned Richard Nixon. And as we learned from history, created a situation where Nixon was really able to redeem himself politically. And in fact, if you remember, Richard Nixon died as something of a statesman. But more than that, far more important than Nixon's really picayune story, the sort of petty side story of Richard Nixon, the failure to see through an impeachment of Nixon at that point really was what ushered in the radical growth of the imperial presidency, which we now have. We have a president who clearly has a dominant position over the Congress and often rules in a monarchical manner, as we see with things like signing statements. And so I think Congress made a terrible mistake by not doing a post-presidential impeachment there. And there is an argument that if this Congress cannot muster the wherewithal, the courage to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney during their tenure, that a post-presidential or post-term impeachment of either or both men would be appropriate. But I will tell you that my reading of the political dynamics are that that's very unlikely. A new president will be in office. America tends to be a country that likes to forget rather than focus on past errors. And so the likelihood is that the best and perhaps the only time when George Bush and Dick Cheney can be held to account is in this period between now and January 20th of 2009. I think that we fool ourselves if we say that there's much chance of a impeachment after January 20th, 2009. And so I believe this is the time to do it. And there really is an imperative, a moral imperative, to reference something David said earlier, to act at this time. To simply say, well, we're going to put it off till the next election, at a point when George Bush just finished a State of the Union address last night in which he was saber-rattling once more with regards to Iran and sending it off with a lot of very dangerous signals as regards the world, is foolish. George Bush is not sending any signals whatsoever that he believes his presidency is done, that he is, you know, giving up the ghost and that he's not going to do anything in this last year. Quite the opposite. He's sending every signal that he intends to be a very aggressive, full-on president during his final year. And so the idea that we should step back and wait till he's finished to try and hold him to account, I think is very foolish and also, frankly, quite dangerous, both for the Republic and also for the world itself.
This is what I wanted to get to, John. If you look just at a handful of the headlines from the past 24 hours or so, you know, we have the former governor of Alabama beginning his eighth month today behind bars, arguably as a political prisoner. We have the Justice Department in an LA Times story apparently blocking, predictably enough, their internal investigation of Gonzalez's politicizing of hirings and firings. We have the State of the Union address, as you've mentioned, with familiar misleading statements about Iraq and Iran and about having prevented terror threats, identical lies in some cases that were made in the 2007 State of the Union. We have repetitive reports of the White House rewriting reports by government scientists on global warming. We have, with Blackwater still yet to be held to account for any of its killings in Iraq, we have citizens here in the U.S. who reenacted a Blackwater killing, put through a secret trial and behind bars. We have a member of the FBI telling us what most of us always knew, that Saddam Hussein was not a friend of Osama bin Laden. We have the president eliminating a Freedom of Information Act office that deals with replying to Congress's requests for information. We have a town in Vermont taking a vote on whether to arrest Bush and Cheney if they should set foot there. And then I think most glaringly, most arrogantly, and most impeachably, we have this latest signing statement on the same day as the State of the Union, I surmise in an attempt to get it out there with no one noticing. Bush signed this defense authorization bill into law, quote-unquote law, as we still understand it, and notes four sections that he gives himself the right to violate, and they are: he doesn't need to probe into contractor fraud. He doesn't need to take steps to protect whistleblowers. He doesn't need to provide Congress with documents requested, and he does not need to ban permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq. On the contrary, he can continue to build and maintain them. If the people who wrote the Constitution, if the founding fathers of this nation saw that signing statement, what would they say?
Well, I think they would be horrified, and their immediate reaction would be you have to impeach. I mean, remember, the signing statement is, I don't think the highest crime or misdemeanor of this administration. The fact of the matter is that leading the country into an illegal and immoral undeclared war is the quintessential high crime. It's exactly what the founders were thinking about when they drew up their sections of the Constitution on impeachment. But the signing statements are probably the best example of the way in which this presidency has become imperial, that it has become monarchical. Because what did the king do? What did any king always do? He would rule by royal decree. He would say, this is what I think, this is what I want, and so it shall be the law of the land. And he excluded himself from provisions which might hold him to account, that might make him the equal of a common citizen, a commoner. And so we set out to create a republic that didn't work that way, that rejected those kinds of behaviors, that kind of approach. There was never any mystery about the American intent. There was never any mystery about why we fought the Revolution or why we wrote the Constitution. And yet today, 220-some years after the Constitution was written, we have a president who does exactly what a king used to do, ruling by royal decree. And amazingly enough, we have the legislative branch, the House of Representatives, which was given the power to prevent such excess, given the power to prevent such abuse, doing nothing. And it is, to me, I don't know who to get more upset with, George Bush for abusing his powers or Congress for letting him abuse his powers. But at the end of the day, I have to say that Congress has a more fundamental responsibility here, because I think we've always assumed that presidents would take more power unto themselves than is appropriate. But the preventative for that, the protection against that, has always been an aggressive and self-respecting Congress. And unfortunately, I think today we have a toothless and self-deprecating, dysfunctional Congress that has allowed Bush to be Bush. And that's, you know, that's the frustration of the moment. There are certainly members of Congress who don't fit into that description. I'm very, very cognizant of and impressed by, proud of those members of Congress who have stood up and spoken out for impeachment, who've signed on to resolutions, who've voted, in fact, at key procedural moments in favor of impeachment. There are many of them, to be sure, but there's not enough, and unfortunately they're not in the leadership of this current Congress, and that's a shameful reality, shameful not just in the moment of George Bush's presidency, but really in the history of the Republic, because they take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And frankly, at this point, by allowing George Bush to do these signing statements and to continue to govern in the manner that he is, they are not living up to or holding themselves to that oath they swore.
I want to talk with you a little bit about Congress and what's happening there and what steps, if any, Congress has been taking and can take other than impeachment. But we do have to take one quick break in the middle of this program, and we've arrived at that point. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio with our guest John Nichols, and we'll be returning after the break, and we'll be taking your calls toll-free at 1-888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Back in a few.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by After Downing Street.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of science, spirituality, activism, politics, literature, healing, entertainment, and education. Make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak, Tuesdays, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
Maybe we're
And this is David Swanson back with you at the People Speak Radio, where our guest is John Nichols, the author of The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism, among other terrific books, including one on our vice president with the title Dick. You can call in and speak with John Nichols toll-free at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. John, just to continue my devil's advocate role with one more question, one that we often hear from a number of Congress members and staffers is that impeachment is all well and good, but it would distract from more important things. And I've had a hard time figuring out how that would work and what those more important things could be. What's your response to that argument?
You know, look, there's two ways to respond to that argument. The first one is to say, what exactly is this Congress accomplishing? I mean, if they were really at the stage of dotting the I's and crossing the T's on a single-payer national health care system, and they were saying, you know, look, we are about to solve for all time this nation's health care crisis, and a fight over impeachment might lose us the 10 Republican votes we needed to do that, then I might listen to them. I'd still say they were wrong, but I'd at
least listen to them. But it would be vetoed, right?
Well, but even if they were saying, yeah, we got to deal with Bush, if they were saying, you know, we got the whole package and we really are going to do this amazing thing, we're going to give every child in America health care forever and every adult as well, you know, then maybe if they were saying, you know, look, we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's on a full withdrawal of all of our troops from not just Iraq, but from all the other places they shouldn't be in around the world, well, then I might listen to them. But they're not doing that, David. They're not doing anything like that. So on the practical level, it's an absurd argument. Now,
right, but it,
on the constitutional level.
But, John, can't you look a little a bit broader at their possibilities and say, look, I don't need to examine this children's health care bill to see if it reaches some stellar level. I know if it's any good, it'll be vetoed. And if it's horrendous,
right,
it'll become law, right? So, I mean, do we even have to examine?
But I don't think we have to go that far. I'm just saying, David, I'm just saying practically, if they were doing something consequential that looked like it had a shot at becoming law and might really do some good for the American people, well, then maybe they could make a practical case against moving forward on impeachment. I mean, they could make that case, and I would listen to them. But the fact of the matter is that my ultimate response would be that when you sacrifice the Constitution, even for a practical good, even for a positive bit of progress at some point, you begin the way down a very dangerous path, which is really the path to fascism. Because remember, if you say that we're going to put the Constitution on hold, we're going to put our duties to the Republic and to maintaining the rule of law on hold because we can do something good, because we have the opportunity to do something that we think is really positive for the people, then what's to stop some future president or Congress with far more nefarious and dangerous intents from saying, well, we're putting the Constitution on hold because we're doing something good? I mean, the bottom line is impeachment ought never be seen as a barrier to accomplishing anything. The fact is that during Nixon's presidency, when Democrats in Congress were moving to impeach him, they were also raising the minimum wage, expanding housing, expanding health care programs, and bringing to an end the illegal bombing of Cambodia and ultimately the illegal war in Vietnam. I mean, they were accomplishing a lot during the same time as they were impeaching Richard Nixon. In fact, to be honest, if we use the Nixon period as an example or as a model, the argument ought to be that Democrats should move immediately toward impeachment so they can get something else done. But at the bottom line, in the most basic level, with no humor or irony here at all, I believe that when you swear an oath to uphold the Constitution, your first responsibility is to do that, that everything else extends from that. And to suggest that somehow they have more important work than upholding the Constitution, than holding a illegal and immoral presidency to account, is an absurd and completely unacceptable excuse for inaction. It shouldn't be respected or accepted, and I've never understood how Democrats in Congress could say with a straight face that they are accomplishing anything or doing anything consequential enough to put presidential accountability aside. As you point out, this president can veto just about everything they do except impeachment. Amusingly enough, impeachment is the one power, the one authority they have in which they don't have to negotiate with George Bush and Dick Cheney. So, to my mind, it probably ought to be the first priority.
He can't veto it, and he can't signing statement it. I want to bring a caller in on this conversation, John, and it's a little disturbing to me. His name is Dick, and his location is undisclosed. So who knows who's coming on the show with us here? But let's go to Dick. You're on the People Speak Radio with John Nichols.
Hi, David. Hi, John. It's great that you're on the radio with John. I can't believe that your two minds are all in the same place at one time. Anyone that wants to listen to John, by the way, I'm calling from Tucson, but I have roots in Wisconsin. Anyone wants to listen to more John, just go to WPR.org, and he's a regular guest on shows there and does a great job. Here's my question.
It's nice of you to say.
Well, I'm more than happy to do it. Here in Tucson, there are two members of Congress, Raul Grijalva and Gabrielle Giffords, and both Democrats. Some of us have been working for 3 years to get Raul Grijalva to sign on to impeachment, but it wasn't until we had a forum in town where we had a mock debate and Raul Grijalva did not show up even though he was invited. And it was pointed out that he has been dragging his heels on this. 4 days later, he signed on. So that's the first thing I want to mention, that local action, for those people listening out there saying, nothing will happen if we, you know, no matter what we do, nothing will happen. He only had to be embarrassed in public once, and he signed on. The second thing is that since that forum, we have been regularly lobbying in front of Gabrielle Giffords' office once every week, asking people to honk for impeach. And she can hear, and her staff can hear, all that honking that's going on outside of her office. Now, we haven't been able to sway her yet. Here's my question. We're wondering how easy it would be to run, to ask a polling company to do polling in her district to find out what her constituents feel about this president, this vice president, and whether or not they've committed impeachable offenses. Do either of you know anything about how that would be done, how much it might cost us, since we don't believe Congressman Giffords will do it herself. If we were able to pull the money together, how much might it cost us, and would that be a strategy either one of you would endorse?
Okay, Dick, good points and good questions. Let's let John respond.
Well, first off, I want to celebrate one aspect of what you said, especially, and that was that when you held a public forum, when you sort of put this issue out in a very open, very public way within Raul Grijalva's district, though he didn't show up for the forum, he very quickly signed on for impeachment. We've had the same experience all over the country. We held a forum in Maxine Waters' district. Hello? Next day. Hello, can you hear me? David? Hello?
Hello, John.
Hello? Yes, I'm here, David. Can you hear me?
I can. We had a technical glitch there. It seems I think we're back on. Go ahead with your response to the caller, Dick.
All I was saying is that when hearings have been held around the country, members quickly signed on. I mean, doing these public events matter. When we held one in Maxine Waters' district, the next day she signed on for impeachment. When we held one in Bob Brady's district in Philadelphia, within 3 weeks he signed on for impeachment. When we held one in Tammy Baldwin's district, within 2 weeks she signed on for impeachment. You know, these events do matter. They do have an impact. Now, if a member is resistant even to that level of activism, to public forums and petitioning and protest, then I certainly think that polling is a valid tool. That does cost a little money to do a quality poll. Can't even get into the range of $10,000 to $15,000, which is a lot of money, and your money might be spent better in other ways. But if you can find that level of resources, if you have it, you can hire Gallup, the Gallup polling firm, which a name that everybody knows and respects, is available for hire. I mean, they use their standard sampling techniques. They are very professional. I've run Gallup polls for newspapers. I know how it's done. And the fact of the matter is I'm quite certain that working with a firm like Gallup or a more affordable one like Zogby polling, which a lot of people hire in different settings, you could develop a set of polls that would be or a set of questions that would be very professionally drawn, very responsible, take those questions into the field, and I can guarantee you, you'll get the result you want, because the fact is that everywhere where polling, good polling has been done with serious questions, we found strong support for impeachment. In fact, nationally now, for Cheney, it's over 50%. For Bush, it's right in the range of 50%, just a little below in some polling, although that was a while ago. It's probably up at this point. And so bottom line, if you can find the resources, you can contact any of a number of major polling companies and go into the field and do this. And a good poll can be done in a matter of a week or not much more. And that's from the time when you sign the contract with the polling company to when you draw up the questions, get them in the field, and get the results. This is something I wish we had more resources in the impeachment movement. We probably would be doing it district by district across the country, but if you can find the resources in Gabrielle Giffords' district to do it, I would say go for it. It's a very commendable and perhaps quite effective initiative.
John, if I could just add to that, if you go to a coalition website called afterdowningstreet.org and click on polling at the top or type in /polling, you'll find not only all the polls that have been done at the local or national level on impeachment, but also the history of having polls rejected by Gallup and other companies that simply refused to do a poll that included impeachment, even for good, cold, hard American cash. So you will run into problems of that sort, and you have to work around it and find another company. But if you find a company willing to do a poll, and you're going to do a good poll, and you let me and others in the impeachment movement know, we can raise thousands and thousands of dollars very, very quickly online to do these sorts of polls, and have done it in the past, and it's a very, very effective tool. John, we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to ask you what I think is really a critical question, and it may not be a simple yes or no answer, but there are those now pushing as
a second best thing to impeachment hearings, non-impeachment hearings. That is, let's get the Judiciary Committee to do some hearings on obvious impeachable offenses, but not call them impeachment hearings because they're unwilling to do that, and that scares Nancy Pelosi. And my and I don't know whether you support this as a good idea or not, my question has been to people who do, what will differentiate these hearings from the past 12 months of hearings that weren't impeachment hearings, most of which didn't even make it on C-SPAN, witnesses refused to show up, etc. And if we do new hearings that aren't impeachment hearings, and impeachment advocates think that that's helping, will that drain some of the pressure for impeachment? So does it hurt us, does it help us, or is it a wash to start yet more hearings without that I word in there?
That's a great question, David. And as you know, I'm somebody who believes in using the I word. And I think that far from being frightened by it, we should embrace it, and there should be no hesitancy. And I've counseled members of Congress along these lines in my conversations with them many times. But there is this incredible resistance. And so I think that there is an argument for hearings on issues related to what we think of or what we see as impeachable offenses, if those who conduct the hearings say at the beginning of the process that they are not foreclosing any options for response. I mean, that's the critical thing. If hearings of the kind you describe go forward, and from the very beginning it's said that this is being done as an alternative to impeachment, or if they will say, you know, look, we just want to get this on the record, we don't want to do anything about it, then I'd have to agree with you. I think it's a waste of time. On the other hand, if there is an honest upfront statement that we want to hold these hearings, we want to get this information on the record, to have this public, go in this public setting, and we foreclose or we close down no avenue of response to this, then I'm not particularly bothered by it. I don't see why we don't just go straight to impeachment hearings. That would be my choice. But I'm not one of those people that believes or thinks that all Americans are fully aware of the high crimes and misdemeanors of the Bush administration. As much as I wish that was true, I know the horrible failures of American media. And I know that when I went on Bill Moyers' show to talk about impeachment with Bruce Fein last summer, I was absolutely blown away by the thousands of communications I got from people saying, wow, I didn't know we could do this. I didn't know that you could hold a president to account. And also, who had not begun to put all the pieces together until they had seen that show. And so I think that well-conducted hearings that hold out the option of impeachment are, you know, I can live with that. What I can't live with is the notion of doing hearings simply for the sake of doing hearings, simply to create a permanent record or do something like that, because I do think that would run the very real risk of streaming energy away from accountability. And ultimately, that's the critical thing here. We want to hold Bush and Cheney to account, not because we particularly care about punishing individual men. We, you know, think that George Bush and Dick Cheney deserve that level of our passion or emotion. We do it because we want future presidents to know that they cannot operate in this lawless and anti-constitutional manner. And so I think that just having hearings without any sort of avenue for accountability, without any sort of avenue for response to the information that is accumulated in those hearings becomes dangerous, because it does make Congress little more than a debating society.
This is sort of a side issue, because we have such an extensive menu of impeachable offenses, and they can choose
to investigate, right,
and impeach for what they want. But I want to ask about the issue that you said seemed the most impeachable, and that is the war and the lies about the war. Because in 2005 and 2006, with the Democrats in the minority, they were making a lot of noise, pushing resolutions of inquiry, trying to get votes, holding pseudo-impeachment hearings, talking up preliminary steps to impeachment, and even shutting down the Senate and forcing it into closed session. From the moment the Democrats took the majority, there's not been one word, and even this discussion of possible additional non-impeachment hearings doesn't seem to include the lies about the war. And a Republican or a Libertarian candidate for president, Ron Paul, is the only presidential candidate who said he would be willing to hold that investigation after he's president. I can't imagine hearing that from any of the other Republican candidates or any of the Democrats now that Kucinich is out of the race. How important is it that we get to that particular investigation, and what is blocking it?
Well, of course, those are two very different questions. The first, how important it's the essential investigation. Again, the biggest mistake that was made in the Nixon impeachment back in 1974 was that Congress didn't move forward with a proposal by Father Drinan, Elizabeth Holtzman, and John Conyers to impeach Richard Nixon for the illegal bombing of Cambodia. That should have happened. It was essential that that happened because it would have sent the most powerful signal to future presidents about what they could and could not do in a military sense with their presidential powers. So, I mean, to my mind, there's no more important responsibility of Congress at this point than to examine the lies that were used to take us to war with Iraq and to hold those who lied accountable. Remember, we just had a study come out last week that detailed, I think it's 935 clear lies told by President Bush and members of his administration in the run-up to the war with Iraq about the reasons for going to war with Iraq. We were deceived, and that study's been done. That information is there. That's the sort of thing you ought to open a congressional hearing on the next morning. I mean, this is not a debatable point at this time. And so I think you have the people who just did that study come in, detail their research, make sure it looks accurate, and then move the impeachment offenses. Because remember, lying to Congress about the reasons for going to war, that's the ultimate impeachable offense. That destroys the system of checks and balances, where a commander-in-chief is supposed to consult with the Congress, which has the sole power to declare a war. It also, of course, is an egregious violation of the oath of office, which is to uphold the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. When you're launching wars without proper authority and without the truth on your side, you aren't defending the country against enemies, foreign and domestic. You are creating enemies, and that's just a completely unacceptable thing. So,
why is that off the table?
I think because we have a military-industrial complex in this country every bit as horrifying as the one that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, and that most Democrats are little better than Republicans when it comes to standing up to illegal war-making, war profiteering, and all the other crimes that are associated not just with the war in Iraq, but with most of our wars since World War II. That's just the painful reality of it. I mean, you know, look at the Democratic candidates for president at this point. They're barely able to bring themselves to say that they would, you know, try to get most of the troops out during their first term as president of the United States. And in fact, the truth is, if you listen to them, you know, seriously, there's no question that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are both saying that they would keep some forces on the ground in Iraq throughout their first term and probably into a second term. Well, the size of that force might be debatable, but they would have a U.S. presence. John Edwards is, to my mind, a little bit better on this, but not dramatically so. And so, I mean, that's the Democrats. Of course, the Republicans are worse. With the exception of Ron Paul. So I hate to say it. It's painful to me to say it because it is such a tragic assessment of our current circumstance. But I think we have a Congress that is not inclined toward holding the president to account for illegal war making, because they are not inclined to stop an illegal war. And that's the painful reality.
Well, then this Democratic complicity in some of these abuses extends beyond the war. And we learn, in recent months how early some of the Democrats knew about the spying or about the torture, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And yet there would seem to be some impeachable offenses, perhaps most starkly the use of signing statements to reverse laws passed by Congress, in which you can't argue that that any of the Democrats are complicit, and that ought not to be what's stopping them from moving ahead with impeachment.
I agree with you completely. Complicity also shouldn't be, it doesn't matter either, because, remember, the Constitution does not outline the impeachment power for the executive only in the circumstance where the Congress is pure as driven snow. The fact of the matter is that a Congress that authorized a president to go to war on the basis of lies from that president should feel no hesitancy whatsoever about impeaching that president for those lies. I mean, those lies are one of the reasons that we're at war. So even if you, as a Democrat in Congress or a Republican, voted wrong in the past on any of these issues, even if you had knowledge of these issues, that should not be an excuse for not taking action to impeach. It might be an excuse for voters in your own district to remove you from office at the next election. But, again, what troubles me is there are so many members of Congress who just keep looking for some excuse for not doing what they're supposed to do. And the excuses are what kill us at the end of the day, because if the Constitution is no longer a pure document, one that simply tells us what the rule of law is and it's at least in clear areas gives us a direction to go, if it becomes something so fluid that we can always make an excuse for not obeying it, then it doesn't matter. Then it really is just what George Bush calls it, a piece of paper.
John, on that note, I think we're out of time, and I think we can take away the thought that there are no more excuses for Congress members not to do this, and the failures of our Congress members should be no excuse for citizens not to push for this to happen. John Nichols, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
David, it's an honor. You've been a true champion throughout this impeachment fight, and I'm not going to give up talking about it for the next year, and I know you won't either.
None of us should. And speaking of which, next Monday, February 4th, 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time at the People Speak Radio, I will be interviewing former Senator George McGovern on this very topic. I hope you can join us then. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. Speak with you next week.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry.